Good evening and welcome. Thank you for coming out this evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our fifth fall of the Michigan Writers Series, and we're delighted that you can be here and listen to a wonderful writer and poet. Before I get to introducing him, I would like to just give a few thanks to a few people who helped make all of this possible. I'd like to thank Stephanie Matheson, Michael Rodriguez, Rick Pfeiffer, John Shaw, and also Schuller Books and Music, which is again supporting the Michigan Writers Series. And we're grateful to all of them for making all of this possible. Really, I'm just a figurehead up here. I'm just a talking head. Stephanie is the one who keeps track of all the writers and does the interviews. Michael Rodriguez helps Stephanie and me select the writers and invite them. Michael also does the interviewing tonight. He is in New York City, so we can't be here. Rick Pfeiffer keeps up our wonderful website where we digitize all of the writers who come and visit us and puts them up on the web so the world can listen to what you're listening to this evening. And the incomparable John Shaw takes all the pictures and does the recording and stuffs about a cotton field worth of cotton rags up in these air handling systems so that you can hear the reader read the work without a lot of rattling going on. So I'm eternally grateful to all of them for all of their wonderful work. Now, the introduction of tonight's writer. Dennis Henriksen's recent work, Our Page of Water, a full-length collection of poems, which appeared from the University of Akron Press in August 2004, and a chapbook, Message to be Spoken in the Left Ear of God, which was published by Mayapple Press, also in 2004. His other collections of poetry are The Attraction of Heavenly Bodies, The Rain That Falls This Far, and Detail from the Garden of Earthly Delights, which won the 1999 Akron Poetry Prize. He has been the recipient of a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship and two grants from the state of Michigan. His poems have appeared in American Literary Review, Black Warrior Review, Crab Orchard Review, Field, Notre Dame Reveal, and Passages North, have been featured on the Poetry Daily and the Academy of American Poets websites, and have won awards from the Carolina Quarterly and Poetry Northwest. He teaches at Lansing Community College. And before I ask Dennis to come up here, I'd also like to add that Dennis read here in a wonderful reading along with Jay Featherstone, who's in the audience, February 9th, 2001. The reason I say that date is because I had 6 inches of water in my basement on that date, and I couldn't thoroughly enjoy the reading at the time. If you may recall, for those of us who were around East Lansing at the time, there was a big warm-up after a big snowfall, then we had about 6 inches of rain, and a lot of people had water in their basement. So I was jumping around here, not quite able to concentrate on Dennis and Jay's wonderful reading. So I, for one anyway, will enjoy tonight's reading, and please join me in welcoming Dennis Henriksen.
Thank you very much for coming out on this beautiful evening where Dave Chappelle is over at Breslin. I wish I knew some Dave Chappelle jokes. I want to start with two poems about my daughter. The first one's called Fawn. I shall begin with the deer, that creature built so deftly of balsa and spilled milk, you can't help but desire to cradle it. Arms partially akimbo, boomeranged around its chest and hindquarters, and walk the soft hillside back behind the general store and two rusted pumps, and lay it down again in some perfectly fractured web of daylight, particles, albino rain, easily dappling the unspoiled chamois. You see, we had our daughter with us. She had pressed all she could of her unspoiled flesh into the rear window glass, her forehead flattening to skull, her fingertips ten bloodless moons, the fat-bodied rims of her palms. She was pinched in the harness, her eyes, if the deer could see them, ghosting some even paler line of thought. And then we were up and over the small rise in a long line of summer traffic. She tongued the glass to lick its salt, then nubbed her childhood signs. A for apple, B for bear, C. That's the myth, I suppose, that we could lean down and gather such wildness to spare a child. The deer, of course, was freshly dying, its hindquarters pinned down in half paralysis, front legs striking at concrete, trying to run, its heart still punishing its body with unachievable commandment. Of the child in empathy could sense this. Blood, the color of blood, freshly spilled, mixed slowly with gravel. That place by the side of the road in her mind then, a place of solitude, disquiet, where crows might forage. Is the mic catching all this or is it going in and out? It's okay. It feels like it's going in and out up here to me. It's okay. It is going in and out. Why is that? He did, okay. This is supposed to, I should be able to move and the mic should be able to work.
I can hear you.
You can hear, okay, excellent, thanks. Another poem about my daughter, it has a couple of things that are probably important to know. It's called On Purgatorio One. There's a beautiful moment at the end of the Inferno where Dante and Virgil are leaving the Inferno, and they jump on Lucifer's legs and they start crawling down, and when they reach the center of the earth, they have to pivot and crawl headwards towards his feet to crawl towards purgatory. And so there's this wonderful pivot moment as they go into the first canto of Purgatorio, where Dante is cleansed lovingly by Virgil with the reed of humility. On Purgatorio 1, there's an epigraph. Go with this man. See that you gird his waist with a smooth reed. Take care to bathe his face. Sometimes mercy fell all the way down and made tiny windows in the fields. And sometimes it simply hovered in the 7x20 panes of glass. It's not that I couldn't stand such utter selflessness. One thing passing into another across the distance. It's just that the sun resembled more a burning kite than star, and stained the building with the pinks and muted oranges, muted yellows of its raging sorrow. Still, it held me there, winter sunset, and stood me helpless. The beauty was in the fuel of the thing, how each window banked like ignited water, the red bricks riffling in the perfect residue of seconds. Years later, it was my daughter wandering casually in to watch me bathing that undid me. How she played with the stacked towels a while, toothpaste, soap, until this game bored her, and she turned to me to wash my face and hair as only a child can, in the frank religious spirit of cleansing, nursing. Awed, I let her scrub me. I let the grimed water sheet me like a radiant cloak until this too bored her and she wandered back to play with toys, left me chilled above the whir of traffic. I was in the car again. It was 1968. The dream time was all around me spilling the other's blood, the car that held us such a poor kite to the hill's wind. I remember waking upside down above the pivot and knowing nothing of time but a kind of hurry-up to save the cell life, my father's borrowed jacket on another scrunched beside me in the filtering light. Witless are ritual cleansings, the actual timings. A second window flared beneath me on the bitter earth. I dropped and hurried toward it, crawled hands and knees into the charity and utter coarseness that was ditch grass. We were talking earlier about Bosch painting detail from the Garden of Earthly Delights and how somehow my backyard in Michigan reminded me of the Boschian aspects to it. One of the things that made me think that was, this was some years ago, my grandfather at the time was going mad, and in Iowa, in the Bible Rust Belt on Good Friday in 1990, they strapped my grandfather down and gave him electric shock therapy, which always sort of startled me. Of course, it did no good, but I thought about that, and I was thinking about the Holy Shroud and the wrapping, the stuff that they put around him before they shot him full of electricity. And then also this idea that his middle name was Leroy, which is a great Midwestern name, but in French it means the king, right? And that sort of plays in this as well. So the poem's called What the Shroud Holds, Good Friday, 1990. Pollen of all kinds, fakery in pigment, jeweler's rouge, indentations where a man's thumb pressed down and in to widen gaps between the weaving, 20 twists per inch of fiber. My grandfather laid like soft wax inside the fabric, his body even then on the horizontal plane on point, as if on the plantar nerve, about to ride those first anguished seconds like a bellows. A modesty of crossed hands, axis and pivot, celestial tinctures, his last pitched curse flying over the rubber bit as the charge held and the voltage flashed to the hovering Jesus. In Bruegel's The Expulsion of the Rebellious Angels, and could they mean mere anger here, it is a saint cauterizing the landscape. Angels violently poised above their victims, nothing scurrying away, angling for cover, but accepting, actually helping, flying into the swords, exposing with delicate hands their split intestines. But never the iridescence I would rub from a moth. I'd clean the powder with my tongue sometimes. He'd watch, just to taste it, or swipe it in broad strokes on the ball of my wrist. He'd hone his jackknife to a keener smoothness, then peer like me at the assembled wreckage, orange bands and yellows of lightning, crushed reds, some of them marked with star charts and the shapes of planets, though now and then a single butterfly would snap brutally out of the domestic ether, flutter across blades of daylight. So slowly, I couldn't help but watch. He'd be bored with me by then, disgusted, a scrap of paper caught in an updraft or ash on which I'd seen some writing floating back to the barrel edged with fire. Cross his arms here so that he might linger in soft linens a while. Can I get up now? It's over. You're up. Flannel prints, vellums. Human rapture reduced to this last cloth touch, ecstasy to this day's end waking. He rocks a little in the chair, then moans, the nurse's voice in his ear like a soreness or intolerable law. So he turns, so he looks at me. Can I get dressed now? Can I get ready for bed? I turn in the harsh threaded matrix, no vision, no memory, no healing. And tell him, yes, Leroy, you can dress. I wrote this poem many years ago, but it turns out it's a poem for the Lansing Board of Water and Light. I'm not Catholic, so I didn't have holy water splashed in my head when I was a kid. I was something else. I don't know what it was. So when I was 14, I wandered into a bathtub full of tap water and was dunked backwards. So I'm always, tap water is sort of interesting moment for me, more so now. Lead part and chlorine, copper, iron, tap water I was blessed in. I do a simple thing and sluice its mineral guttings. My thirst slaked, my throat stung with such inelegant fiber in its poor Jerusalem of fact. a couple of poems about my father, who passed away recently, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago. One in which he's still alive. It's called Zen Noise, Zen. Actually, the first line is the title is the first line of the poem. Zen noise, Zen traffic. My father sleeps beneath a wide-bladed fan, head tipped back, arms crossed over belly, bird cry pouring out of him like string or knotted rain. His predicament, of course, is time. Include it all. He cannot include it all. I let mosquitoes feed a while before I wake him. When my father died, he had his pre-planned funeral was a movement through death, cremation, and inurnment at the speed of light. So I needed to slow the process down. I made them get the body back out so I could see it again and spend some time with it and processed through the cremation, which was his wish. I slipped a poem. I decided to add some ritual, so I got a poem of Whitman's and wrote some stuff across it, and then put it in with the body so that Whitman would get burned up with my father. And then I wrote a poem about it. It was one of those moments. I was talking to somebody else about it. It was one of those moments where, as you're going through it, you're going through it because you're a human being and need to go through it. And then another part of you, the writer part of you, goes, "Oh, okay, this is going to be sort of an interesting poem." And it's just sort of, catching my father up on what happened. It's called Whitman Burning. And then you were pulverized coral. The process by which you were rendered to ash beyond my Fahrenheit understanding, as the gauge clicked, as if it were counting a swarm of maddened bees, a degree, it seemed, a second. And the conveyor turned, and the world aluminum door closed down, and those first hot blasts, a choir of tongues, enveloped the box. How many years you worked to fashion such corrugated structures for Coke and Pepsi, Maytag, the washers slipped in and dinged by careless workmen, the cases shaken to their carbonated cores. Now men in lab coats are your deliverance. They had paperwork to do, but let me watch, and so I paced as the hive of fire began its honeyed work. I put a poem of Whitman's there and waited as it too rose in its mineral flash. 2 hours, they said, and then a cool down from that white heat. And then it was all in my hands, the palm, the box, and the blanket, the gold of your teeth. My words inked across the face of Whitman. I made everybody touch you, the little baggie I had, and then I drove to the river. Just up from Davenport, along the Mississippi, I found a flat rock warmed by sun where I could sit and watch a barge slug upstream, swooping gulls. And then I heaved a handful. Some of you was spirited by wind and hissed as it took the current, a gray-white alchemy I was not master of. Some of you fell like bone to the bottom. I had to swish my hands a bit to drive you deeper. And then the barge passed, churning you up. The same or different gulls began their wheeling. I felt better then. I could drive home. I knew nothing more than what I knew before about misery or grief, the river of language, how it twists and dazzles, and finally does not matter, even at 1600 degrees, and it was a relief, actually, no burden, though I wanted to utter your bones. By some last chemical process or blast of metaphysics, Whitman's face pressed so close to the flaring heart stem, the aftershock was vision. Your bones, your riven bones, were ruby, emerald. In a previous life, I was a technical writer working for an engineering firm that built nuclear power plants, which raised some interesting ethical questions solved by the realization that I needed money. What I tried to do at one point, I would walk home from, I would take the, I worked downtown in Boston South Station area. I would take the Red Line home through Harvard Square and then walk. And one of my tasks one winter was to try to memorize Keats' Ode to a Nightingale. So it's kind of a Chernobyl poem about Chernobyl and John Keats. Not likely to find another one that does that. So the poem's called Harbor. And it quotes Keats' wonderful poem, Darkling, I Listen. It begins in Harvard Square and moves towards the water. Mornings of electricity and Jesus. The laying on of hands through subway stations so methodically bruised, I thought my footsteps, the hesitant tapping down some perpetual tunneling. In my head, its crude mosaic, cut in and beveled, no doubt, by saxophone. Some outrageous fiddle music strung from a boot. A shelter and breakdown and inner drifting. And then the long glide under the city. Who was I now? Where was I going? 9 floors up, some days I felt myself as sunlight grazing the Atlantic. In corridors and channels at first between the buildings, an entity of ether so expertly tooled, the hands that labored were ignitable, liquid. On others, it was myself as harbor, chromatic, that is, easily stained. Blues and greens would swirl and overwhelm my vision, or I would become the purple cast just touching the northward, southward turning edges of the water. It would take a coworker's voice or ringing phone to wake me. Everybody stunning in the amniotic haze, one man readying his briefcase to tour Chernobyl. Nobody ranting against the harsher residues of ash, the laying on of concrete. Rather, jokes about Russian women, Russian prophylactics, and how much downwind dirt, pasture, field was contaminated. And so I memorized Keats. As though of hemlock I had drunk, the dull opiate winter skies sinking, numberless reds purpling the crowns of trees. The stanzas going down hard, or was it in, as my mind flared with traffic and the words dissolved? Sometimes it seemed my body was nothing more than a fractured pool of water, succulent mud through which the light extended, all that blonde lumber falling, gold curtain, spill of lenses, the palm somewhere darting, scaled, insubstantial. Some mornings, an orange coming apart in my hands, the mind coming apart in my hands, the cathedrals of light, the designs and layouts. On others, a gull at the ledge, tufted, brutally downed, as if it had swallowed some massive dose of the ocean's chemical therapy, or had some leukemia of the wing, some breakup of celestial waxes. Somebody mumbled about the ugliness of their cries, their shattered wheeled circlings above the harbor. Another eyed the slick flesh, the graying flesh, muttered fricassee and stew, until every worker was cringing with the taste. All of us having gazed at some point to green water, in need of reverie or consoling vision, all of us having seen then the epileptic headshakes as the mother gull stripped for her puling nestlings some few bits of rotted fish. And so I memorized Keats, the meter, the rhyme schemes, my shelter and breakdown, my inner drifting, because what enters the air must also enter the earth, must enter, therefore, the sways of grass, strings of milk, the concrete poured morning and night to contain the rapture. My going home foot stomps, winter evenings, dulling loads of snow, half-life, fallout, meltdown. How in places the snow grew finned and pleated, spilled over the sidewalks in broad, elegant rivers, some of it fully ribbed, reclined, beautiful, feminine. I wanted to toss away my gloves, strip off my protective garments, and kneel down, lay bare hands across it. A different kind of rapture. I had this experience many years ago of having my one and only true haiku moment. I was canoeing and I had binoculars and I was watching sandhill cranes, and as the wind picked up and the wind lifted my hair at the same time I saw it lift the hair, a feather on a sandhill crane, and I thought, oh, unity, the same wind that touches the cranes touches me. But of course, being a Westerner, I had to write a 4-page poem about it. Rapture. Twilight engendered us, drew us out of the cool house where onions, opalescent moons, fell apart in phases. Our reflections streaked in the blade's vegetable moistness to this other clarity of thought, 6 or 7 deer feeding in a field of late summer beans. No movement but that of wind thinly stroking animal presence, our presence to static rapture. The herd centered so it could graze. Our looking centered, cautious. I wanted to reach out and touch her shoulder as a single fawn delicately picked its way downwind to a stand of trees, and an owl, we think, screamed once, and the field shifted to the deeper urgencies of night. I wanted words to have sway. Held breath close instead, observed deer. In the kitchen is where we talk, touch flesh cooking. Let residues and sharp herbs anoint us. The pepper we did not cut for days because of its delicate size and washed out pale green coloring, soft rind in scrambled egg and sliced tomatoes, cayenne, onion, crowns of salsa. My hip brushed hers when she sliced bread, crimson robe playing at bare skin, hers kinetic, then mine domestic, than mine again. Was this any less rapturous than her face in my hands in yellowing light, smell of emollients, plum rose, coral shades, all the contours and boundaries breaking down, so what I held was a landscape coming undone, adding dimension. As air is dimensionless until you notice, as a sheet of river seems one thing, then 4 or 5 shades of green. The sky once, suddenly quiet, then brought alive with swallows in a rough swerve, kingfishers circling tree to wire across the river. 2 males and then a female, rust-marked, a heron's sloppy wing beats. And then the sun coming out in the river's bronzed heaven, muddied golds. I wanted to reach out and touch her arm as the boat swayed, but could not. Wanted to say the cranes, quietly feeding, have become so tarnished from iron in the water, they do and do not resemble deer. And then the wind lifted. I began to speak. The wind touched feathers, skin. A different kind of poem, poem that plugs into Catullus's wonderful couplet, the Odia Damo, I hate and love couplet. If you know your Latin poetry, this is very famous. Frank Bedard, a poet, has taken great liberties with translating it. I can't think of a version of the Latin one that's relatively literal. The one that I like from Bedard goes, "I hate and love ignorant fish who even wants the fly while writhing." This is a poem called Horse Standing in Sunlight. Kind of about something along those lines. Horse standing in sunlight. Witless to think such grazing could wound the sun, and yet the sun seems wounded. Late slippage in a relief of clouds. Fence line plunging the roll of fields, top wires edged precisely with sunlight. She makes a knot of her face, and what lasts is the orbital twist of lilac. Rains drizzle on tin roof, her scent frail as a watermark. Men sometimes fail miserably at love. In the branch dark watery shadow, legs braid, unbraid, curtains drift. A column of thought folds back on itself like a piece of string, so that no movement forward can undo its sorrowful gaze. See how the horse stands, claustral. Not one hoof touching the ground, porous, fluid. The shadow it hovers in, utterly transfixed. The very sign of amplitude, unbidden grace. Its dun coat quivering. The sun's eye and the horse's eye, like ore or nervous water. Sudden impulse, desires to flee. A blue jay's shadow prints its flank with a sharp rip, black glide, then shreds itself to rain and grass top. Downrange, downwind, out of the field of vision, a spring foal on its side, all lung and breath in a nest of grass. They've gone back to watch the ball game finish. The Amish women, cobalt, orchid, teal, mustard yellow, pitch and catch. Hard hits to where the horses stood. Cattle on folded limbs in a trampled corner. On a rise across the road, one horse standing in sunlight. Fence at its back. Wind stippling an acre of tree line to whale skin. A shudder the oaks pick up and spread to the river, the overhanging willows. She makes a knot of her thought and strides tidily into the unwashed dark, the freshly mottled bleed through. Dress richly colored, finely textured, to touch the silence, wreckage of grass, that the horse might continue grazing. Backwash of teal, orchid, cobalt, burnt yellows, rains fine drizzle at daybreak, orbital twist, a man's face gone pale as a watermark. Sudden impulse, but does not flee. Arms slowly raised to fence wire to unwound the sun, that the horse might still in the quiet linger, in the colt awaken and take the apple from her hand. I guess another poem in that sequence, "I hate and love ignorant fish who even wants to fly while writhing." This is sort of a guiding force in these poems. Periodicity. His forearm on enterings caught in an animal's mouth, enameled drag of instinct. He can feel the ulna curve in the hinge of its teeth, as well as the bones in his little finger, such crude dice, fat pudge of his thumb's mound. She pries him loose, embarrassed, her dog clawing at shirt tail, uneven flooring, hollowness of nine rooms around them, hollowness of plant stems, empty jars. Later, pond life stirring out of its haze in a one-dimensional shimmer, their bodies adrift in a stretch of jazz and soft hips and posturings of a sleeping pony. Day's spoke glistening in the wheel of time. She bites the cut in his lip, the sheen of her biting. Her sentences in the wide air diminished like temperature by an order of magnitude, down angling sparks, the air a flooding of clean intent, one wasp under eaves building its nest in tongue-lathered spirals. Periodicity, new day, daylight, imagined columbine, split-petaled azaleas, the road to her house doubled on either side with pasture and Amish carriage, their freestanding horses, his arm on arriving set again to the animal's tooth. I mentioned Bosch earlier. And someday I'm going to write a poem about the actual painting. This is another poem called Detail from the Garden of the Lights. I tricked myself. The book previous to this was called Detail from the Garden of Earthly Delights to distinguish between the two. I think it's a poem about wanting to enter that great middle panel in this world. So it's a poem for my wife. Detail from the Garden of Earthly... not that one. Detail from the Garden of Delights. That which I cannot give to you, I give to you. Fish smell from the river. The house of God, three blocks north, all rusted girder, dead sky. The I-beams tagged with signature and phosphorescence. Daily, we drive past it, say small things, sweet nothings. Your voice... your own, in which an ocean might occur. In Oregon, where I held you once, there was a counterpulse that slipped beneath the roll of breakers and made a ripping sound, an X along the shoreline. Bosch Beach, we call it. Tattooed lovers everywhere, pitched on blankets, amputees, the elderly in the comfort of their contraptions. Downshore, a car tire poked at, burning. Children like half-drowned dogs and half-drowned dogs, clobbered by wave swells, hunkered on their hind legs, wrapped in towels, shivering. The entire 100 yards of human animal flesh stippled with a coming chill, cold star. My arm in yours, the energy along that shifting edge released and ripped, a sliver, no spear of water. This accident of geography, our accident, more a matter now of will than memory, to be transformed and overcome. At our age, Williams says, at our age, the whole process is one of switchbacks, down and back across the bluff, the blinding sand, water. At the far end, three bathers, naked, the earth so flat between the outcrops, gently pitched, the ocean rolls in, nearly weightless, molten silver, air. Sunlight, drizzle of a star. Heat we know will fail us in this great middle panel. We enter, disrobe and walk. The sea, semen-edged sand, that first ground, jeweled, glistening. Fish spirit, bird spirit, animal on animal back, the kingly, lion, panther, griffin, driven, circling, the egg and the owl. At our age, this thorn and thistle bath lifts us to make worlds of spray and stone, lifts us, one of the bathers strolling now, so easily rendered out of the great salt room of the sea to scalding air, the sky everlasting. Thank you very much. happy to answer any questions that you might have.
How do you do it?
That's my neighbor speaking. I do it like, I sit down and write, and I don't know anymore. In answer to it, I think I try to do two things. One is to try to, on one side, collect enough chaos over here, words, ideas, images, to get some movement forward, and then I just try to listen to what those things want, and then allow them the space and time to move forward via language into those things, and just sort of kind of pay attention to things that I'm interested in, things that happen to me, an image here, an event there, and just be smart enough to stay out of the way of it, I think, but continue to type away at it. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
How do you decide which poems to read out loud?
Well, I go over the work and I kind of look at. I guess I'm obsessed by sequences. So if I'm going to sit down and do a reading, I want to read poems that, at least from my point of view, have some kind of connection and move and from a beginning to an end. And then I sit down and kind of go over them and then read or kind of read them out loud or read them silently and read one in front of the other to see what kinds of things happen. When I'm doing that, and then try to come up with a kind of set list with some options here and there, depending on the time. Yes, sir.
I react differently when I read a poem and when I'm listening to someone read poetry. And I wonder, when you write, do you read aloud the poetry that you're writing?
At some point, I always do. I have a tape recorder that sometimes I use to either initiate the poem, or when I get to a point where I want to begin revising it, I'll tape myself reading the poem, sit down in front of the text, and then play the tape back and listen for those dead moments in it when it's not working, and sort of through a re-recording process, go over it again and again and again and again. Or during the revision process, sometimes ideas come at you much more quickly than you can manage with your handwriting or the computer. So particularly when I'm revising a poem, I know there's a dead moment. I'll have to speak the poem to build up the energy to get to a part where I need to fill in, and the tape recorder comes in handy at that moment, because then I can just speak it without worrying about line breaks or whatever, knowing that hopefully my ear is making the unifying musical connections, and then I can play it back and not lose it, which happens sometimes if I try to write it down, I forget what I said. But in the end, it's part of an oral tradition, and I always tell my students this. I live by it, that the ultimate test of the poem is to be able to sit down in your own house alone and read it and not hear those moments where it's not working or not connecting up. There's a kind of a feeling of rightness that is intuitive, but And then the poem works. You could go back and you could name all the sort of technical things that are going on in the poem that make it work. But this sort of intuitive, this body knowledge that tells you the poem works. Jay, there's a guy right behind you, and then I'll get to Jay. Yes, sir. That's a good question. Well, if you don't want to change your career, which in your course of study, the result, the upshot would be you're going to have to stay awake many long nights and just sort of train yourself by reading. Reading not only who's writing now so that you can figure out how to speak in your own time and place, but then you need to go back and read all the dead guys. And good luck. So it's a lot of reading. It's never ending reading. I've done that study, and I know others in the room that write as well. You're just constantly, joyously reading, to look for things, mostly to keep your ear really sharp, so that when you're composing, you're ready to go. But also to look for new approaches to line or new musics that aren't yours that you want to sort of steal from people or learn from. So you're constantly listening to what other people are doing to feed your head and your ear, so that the tools are sharp. You know, some of it is just work. Some of it is just having the tools ready for, so when, you know, the divine comedy hits you, you're ready to go. It's like, I've been writing, you know, for a few days, and now, oh, here's this great poem. Now I can really go to work, because I've been doing my reading and doing the work. Jay.
I was interested in having you think aloud a little bit about John Keats. I mean, it seems to me that I know some of your work pretty well, but I was just thinking about the music and the kind of brocade that you do, and when you said a few minutes ago you try and let the language do its thing.
Yeah, so it's odd that I've memorized a formal poem. But the beauty of Keats is that I would think that if you want to learn how to write formal poetry, you could go to Ode to a Nightingale and memorize that poem and learn about 75% of what you need to know about formal poetry, maybe even more. Because he varies lines, he enjams lines, he buries the rhymes. You don't hear it. I haven't recited in a long time. How does it begin? My heart aches, and a drowsy numbness pains my sense, as though of hemlock I had drunk, or emptied some dull opiate to the drains 1 minute past and lethe wards had sunk. You don't hear the rhymes because they're all circling around, and then he shifts. It's, you know, tis not through, he goes to shorter lines. Tis not through envy of thy happy lot, but being too happy in thine happiness, that thou, light-winged dryad of the trees, in some a melodious plot of beechen green, beautiful caesura, comma, singest of summer in full-throated ease. You go through that entire poem, and you can get blown away by just where he places caesura, how he alternate, you know, how he does metrical inversions, alternates, you know, he throws, I don't know the technical term, troche, whatever, he's got it, he flips an iamb now and then, that just changes the entire nature of the poem. And each stanza is like so wonderfully etched. And so, yeah, I mean, listening to him, you can almost see him think through this encounter with a nightingale and do this. And what I love about the poem is that it's a very simple thing, but yet it's a very complex poem. It's eight parts, it's eight lines, about 64 lines. It goes and explodes this simple thing without ever losing the fleeting moment of it, and yet there's this sort of eternal truth component to it. And I also like it. Stanley Plumley wrote a really interesting essay about it, which I sort of believe in. It's sort of a very zero tolerance approach. But he was talking about poets who go and make up stuff. You know, they fabricate. His example was a guy was writing a poem about a friend of his who had a breakdown in a motel bathroom, and in the poem the guy died. And in reality, he didn't die, and Plumley's response to that was a really unethical kind of thing to do, to make it up, and that the art, the act of the imagination, is dealing with the particular in a truthful, honest way as best you can, and he points to Ode to a Nightingale as the poem that does that. And I share that belief that looking at things and then trying to find language to capture them beautifully, accurately, is a really challenge and important for the imagination. Anybody can sit down and, you know, Carrot walked into a bar and said, you know, give me a beer, you know, and then it ain't, you know, what? Suddenly I'm James Tate, just sort of not looking at things but making up sort of interesting things. I like that other thing as well. The other poem I like too is that I've memorized is Williams' The Ivy Crown, which I made brief reference to in the last poem. Again, another poem that's pretty simple gesture, but I like the multi-texture component of it. Yes, sir?
Can you talk a little bit about the music of the language of poetry? I'm a songwriter, and I'm
Well, that's an excellent question. I don't know if I've ever, you know, there's this idea of sound of the sound of sense, that I don't know if I separate the two. I get the tape recorder out and begin thinking about what the poem is about, and then think about, you know, I guess I look for that first initial music that functions as the key in which the poem's going to be written. And then I just try to stay really close to it as I improvise, follow the implications of the image or the music to explore the beauty of writing poetry. I was leading my students the other night in an exercise, and Frank was there. Maybe, I don't know if you were still there. They said, we don't know, it was a songwriting class, actually, and we were going through all these different kinds of exercises, and everyone was saying, well, we don't know what we're writing about. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's right. Because for me, it was just, I don't either, but I'm going to find out through this particular process. And if you guys give up to it, give up to the implications of some of the things that you put down, the words, the ideas, and begin listening to them and starting getting a feel for what you want to say, the emotion, the understanding of language, ultimately later on the music that gets added to that by a process that's predominantly intuitive, you know, we'll come out with this finished thing here. So I guess in answer to your question, I just listen to it and until it feels right to me. Now, having said that, there's a bunch of technical stuff. I can go in, and when a poem's flat, I can, you know, pretty much tell you why with all this technical jargon and all that. And with a song lyric, too, there's a ton of interesting books that can help you understand song form and how to blend odd and evens and play around with common meter if you want, or how to, you know, if the chorus is not working, you can figure out why, or if the verses aren't moving the story forward, you can figure out why. Yes, sir.
In your published poems, what's the longest one and the shortest amount of time that it took you to finish your poem? The longest and shortest one.
That's a good question. There's a poem in one of the earlier books that I started when I was in grad school. I spent 5 minutes on it, and then 13 years later, on my way to bed, the idea occurred to me again, and I worked on it for 4 hours, and then it was done. So I don't know if I worked 4 hours or 13 years on it.
What do you know when the poem is done, though?
I don't know. He asked, how do you know when a poem's done? There's the Miles Davis quote, how do you know when the improvisation is over? He says, when I take the horn out of my mouth. Paul Valery says, you don't finish a poem, you abandon it. So it's, again, I don't know, that's a feeling of rightness that you have when you're making a work of art that you could go out very technically, but you're looking at just how it feels when you look at it, feels when you sing it, feels when you say it to somebody, if it captures it. In the end, the arrangement of that music and that meaning is so provisional that you've got to go back the next day to the blank page and start over again. Last question.
I have a question about publishing. I guess my question is, when you decide that you have enough poems to make a book, and let's say you published a few in journals here and there, what is the next step?
For most of us, it's making many copies of your manuscript. Getting a big pile of envelopes and writing a lot of reading fee checks for the many, many contests that are out there. It's the on one level, there are multiple places. On the other hand, though, there are many people trying to place their manuscripts with these particular contests. But some of them, like the New Issues one, they get Michigan funding. They're looking for Michigan writers. They get judges in, they pick a winner, and then they publish maybe, in some cases, four. The last judge picked 7 additional manuscripts to publish. So that's probably the best venue for a beginning writer. Trying to land with some of the bigger presses is won't happen, unfortunately. Thank you very much.